In this episode, I'm in conversation with Laura Neal. Hello and welcome to a new episode, and the first of a new batch of episodes of the QI Guy in Conversation With podcast. I'm your host, as usual, Jonathan O'Reilly, and it's nice to have you joining us. I'm excited about some of the episodes we've got coming up, having a chat around different NHS organisations, different roles, and also potentially getting into QI and continuous improvement in different industries and public sectors, which will be really exciting. Today I'm chatting with Laura Neal, and we have a great conversation about Laura's journey into QI from an AHP perspective. Laura is an occupational therapist by background. We talk about NHS 24's Quality Month, which is ongoing as you listen to this, and you can find their socials in our show notes and connect and find out what's happening there, and kind of a bit of the importance of something like a quality month or a quality week as part of your overall QI strategy. Full disclosure, there is a wee bit of a dropout in the audio, using some new equipment, so right about the kind of 22 minute mark, you might notice a wee kind of jarring change in the audio. Tried my best to recover it, but as an improver, I will learn from my mistakes and what went wrong, and we'll resolve that for the next episode. Speaking of episodes, you can go back and listen to, I think, around about 20 plus episodes in the archives, which you can do through the Anchor website, where I produce this podcast, or whatever you get your podcast. We are available on Apple, Spotify, Google, Amazon, and all the rest, so you can find us wherever you are. Going to plug another podcast as well before we jump into the conversation with Laura, which is The Leadership Log. I'm sure many of you who also listen to this podcast will listen to the wonderful Becky Thomas and the Leadership Log Pod Crew, as she likes to call them. I was privileged to be a guest on their Go With The Flow podcast, talking about all things QI with Becky and answering some of your questions on QI. So definitely go and check that out, give them a subscribe. It's a great podcast. They do some great kind of focus on leadership and digital as well as improvement. So time for my conversation with Laura. Welcome back to the podcast, and I'm delighted to be joined by Laura Neal. How are you doing, Laura?
I'm fine, thank you.
Thanks for joining me. A busy time for you guys. You are the director of, is it head of quality improvement and clinical governance at NHS 24?
Yeah, so I'm in the interim role of head of clinical governance and quality improvement. My main role at NHS 24 is lead for allied health professions, but the current post holder is under secondment, so I'm covering the clinical governance and QI role as well at the moment.
And of course, anyone who knows you will know that you have experience in that role. You're a previous director of QI, was it North East London Foundation Trust?
That's right, yeah, so NELFT, so next door to the famous ELFT, yes. North East London Foundation Trust. I had a split post there as well, so half my role was director of allied health professions and psychological therapies, and the other half was director of quality improvement, and we also incorporated clinical audit into the quality improvement team as well. So
excellent.
Yes, it's nice to be back and doing a bit of QI work again. It's really nice.
Yes, and back here in Scotland, because I'm sure that was quite a significant shadow that was cast by our friends in ELF. They do some fantastic work. So NHS 24, some people might be listening to this and thinking, what is NHS 24? I mean, could you give us a wee description of the service that's offered through NHS 24?
Yeah, so NHS 24 provides a range of different services. So essentially, we're sort of the I guess, the Digital Health and Care Service for Scotland. We, as I say, have a range of services. Most people will be familiar with the 111 service, where people call us and we triage them, if you like, to the most appropriate route in the urgent care pathway. But we also have NHS Inform, which is a website with lots of different health and care information on there. And there's other services as well. But those are probably the two that people are more familiar with.
Yeah, I think as a parent, I've used the NHS 24 service out of ours a number of times, and it works really, really well. I actually didn't realise you ran the kind of NHS Inform website as well. So you're learning, I'm learning something. I'm sure there's others learning. So you mentioned that you're obviously a lead AHP, and I'm assuming that was your journey into the healthcare system as an AHP, and it was an occupational therapist role, isn't it? So, I mean, I've had conversations with lots of nurses and medics and different people, but never an AHP. So, what is it that kind of, you know, drives you or gets you interested in, I'm going to be an occupational therapist?
Yeah,
I don't know that the public actually see that as a career or a job within the NHS, really, or the health service. It's all nurses and doctors.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Actually, I was at a conference last week where we were talking about allied health professions and how we try and promote our professions as careers, because I think a lot of our professions aren't very well known. So allied health professions, there's, depending on which list you look at, around 14 different professions. So it includes physiotherapy, podiatry, dietetics, orthotist, prosthetist, music therapist, and others. And there's been some interesting, there was some research done that showed that actually most people learn about the professions through contact, whether that's a family member that's in a role, mm-hmm. or actually themselves, or a friend or relative has needed the services of one of those professions. So there's definitely a bit of a task for us in promoting ourselves a bit more, because actually we're the third biggest part of the workforce in the NHS.
Yeah, and you know, the health service is under pressure, you know, all areas of the health service are under pressure with increasing demand, and there's so much, I think, scope to do more through that AHP route, because sometimes that's what people need rather than a kind of nursing or medical mm-hmm. intervention. I'm a kind of, I like music, musicians. I've grown up playing the guitar and all that kind of stuff. And it's one of those things where you need to be, you know, excellent. You need to really excel at the music side of things to actually go and be famous and do whatever you want to do. But actually, when you reach that point where you're like, okay, so I'm not going to be in Top of the Pops, don't know if that's still a thing, potentially how do you draw people in like that into music therapy and HP, or people who are maybe interested in sports and pursuing professional sports and that kind of falls out. So I think there's a real opportunity there, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I think the range of settings that allied health professions work in, so, you know, absolutely, you know, from music therapy to physiotherapy, but, you know, a lot of physios work in sport and, you know, football clubs, ballet, you know, there's lots of different settings that physios work in. And even as occupational therapists, you know, where some of us work in healthcare, some of us in, you know, social work settings, education, housing, private practice as well. So, yeah, there's mm-hmm. there's such a range of settings. So, yeah, so I think there is something about how we promote the work that we do, both to people thinking about it as a career, but also within the health and social care system as well, you know, where we can really have an impact. And, you know, a lot of the work we do is about trying to help people to help themselves. Actually, it's about rehabilitation and, you know, preventative approaches. So, you know, we could be even more key, really, in the whole health and social care system. So, yeah, it's how we promote that is.
Absolutely, absolutely. Most people don't know about it until they need to access it. So that sounds like a nice quality improvement project within AHP, is how do you increase that awareness and understanding? And that's a nice kind of segue, because I'm always really interested. So I'm non-clinical, But people who get into the NHS in a clinical role, nurse in HP, medic role, and then they somehow find themselves in the world of quality improvement or governance or clinical audit. What was it for you that kind of, either showed you the potential or got you interested again in actually kind of moving into to more like a QI role?
Yeah, so I've been an occupational therapist. I've been qualified 25 years, and I guess when I look back, I was always someone that was really interested in sort of trying to understand, I guess sort of being curious and, always interested in service development type work. If there was a project to do, I was always the one to put up my hand and offer to do the project. And I then went and did a postgrad certificate in clinical audit and research, but carried on sort of down that clinical route and, was a head occupational therapist. And then I guess my first sort of entry into the world of quality improvement, where it was called that, because I think actually I'd been doing a lot of that, but without the formal methodology or knowing what it was called. Was in 2013, so I was working in London. I was a clinical lead occupational therapist at King's College Hospital and working with older people. So my clinical backgrounds of older people, frailty, neurology, stroke, and a post came up at UCL Partners, which is one of the academic health science networks, and it was for a frailty program manager. And someone had emailed me the job advert. I think it was 2 days before the job closed, but I applied and was successful and took the gamble actually to leave a permanent band-aid post in the NHS, which there's not that many of really for HPs, to take a year's temporary contract at UCLP. But it just opened my eyes to a whole other world and way of thinking, and I guess made some of the work that I'd been doing kind of make sense and put a framework to it. So then worked at UCL Partners for 3 years, was lucky enough to go to the I went through the Sheffield Microsystem Coaching Academy course during that time, and just felt like my way of thinking had really changed over that time. But I guess I was always also, also thinking, but I am an occupational therapist. I kept doing some clinical bank work all that time, but when then the post at NELFT came up that was, linked sort of the quality improvement and the AHP, it felt like I wanted to get back into being in a provider organisation, I guess, and feeling that I could really apply some of that learning I'd had at UCL Partners, which was amazing, but really apply that properly back in the real world again. So the post at NELFT just felt like my dream job really when it came up.
I mean, there's so many points you just made there, Laura, that kind of resonate. And I've heard other people talk about that idea of their first their jump into that QI world is usually through that fixed term post bit of money, just go and get it. But there's always that innate curiosity that someone holds, and they're just curious about the way things work and how they can make things better, and that begins to kind of formalize it. And you've done the Sheffield coaching, the microsystems coaching course, which I've had the guys on the podcast as well, a couple of episodes back, and that's a really great approach, a really great methodology to use. So what kind of things were you doing when you went into that kind of director role at NELF? Like, what was the QI culture like? What kind of infrastructure? What was your kind of QI priorities, if you like?
Yeah, so when I went to NELF, really, I guess it was a little bit of a blank sheet of paper around quality improvement. That really there wasn't anything formal set up in the organisation. They had participated in a frailty academy, which had been led by UCL Partners. So I'd been kind of involved in that, and that was around looking at A&E attendances of older people and trying to think about how we improved some of those pathways. So NELFT were really key in the Frailty Academy. So I'd worked with them, and I think that had kind of given them a little bit of an appetite for quality improvement. And Steve O'Connor, who's one of the associate medical directors, and give a shout out to Steve, he really flew the flag for quality improvement in NELFT and, said, actually, let's, take the success of the Frailty Academy, because it had some really great outcomes, and think about how we embed some of this in the organization. So really my job was to set up and sort of think of, set up a quality improvement program within the organization. So there was a team of a practice improvement team that sort of came over into quality improvement and worked with them to set up and then run a quality improvement program in the organization. So we were really starting from,
Starting from scratch, yeah.
yeah, which was really exciting, to go into a post with that opportunity. Looking back, I guess it was quite daunting, but actually, really exciting. You don't often get an opportunity to really get in right from the beginning like that.
Yeah, that's often the case. You're going into a role like that. It's maybe been established, and quality improvement certainly it is now the kind of the predominant methodology for change in the NHS. So yeah, you're usually getting off the back of someone. Yeah, so that's really interesting. So I take it that a big focus in infrastructure, capacity and capability building, training, toolkits, different things like that. Was that your kind of main focus, or was it just diving straight in and actually getting your hands dirty and, how can we do this work on the shop floor?
Yeah, so I guess a bit of both. So there was plans to sort of run a QI facilitator. So there's always lots of discussion about what we call different levels of QI training, isn't there? But to run a QI facilitators program, and the team had gone through the QSAR training, which was an NHS England thing at the time. But at the same time as actually, okay, let's get started with something, there was a lot of thought given to the approach that we would take, and I'm really always stress the combination of the top down and the bottom up approach to quality improvement. So how do we link this with organizational priorities but also make it meaningful for our staff who know the system better than any of us? So really trying to outline our approach right from the beginning around some of that, and also a lot of thought given to some of the branding. And as I spoke about, what we named each level of QI, but actually we can't underestimate that when you're trying to get something really off the ground, being really clear about branding and messaging. And I think actually that was really important as well. So I guess it was trying to do those three things a little bit at once.
And I'm sure those will resonate with others listening today, because you have to put that infrastructure in place to allow, as I say, quality improvement to happen in a deliberate way, but you don't want it to be so prescriptive that it kind of suffocates that innovation and creativity that might come from the bottom up. Curious people like yourself who are maybe not familiar with the language or the methodology, but they want to make changes, and you don't want them to feel like, well, if I'm not part of the club, sometimes that's how QI can feel, then I can't do it. And I think that branding, that communication, that message is so important as well, because people need to know. I've worked in organizations where you've been there for quite a while and you meet someone and it's like the first time they've, oh, didn't know you existed, didn't know your job, what is it you're doing? It's like, oh, I've been here for ages. So it's really important to actually communicate all that stuff.
And I think we were lucky with kind of two things, really. I think one, that we did have a team, so we had some capacity, as I say, they'd done some QI training, so they were really keen to apply that in practice as well. So we also managed to fund, so myself and a couple of others went through the IHI Improvement Advisor program as well. So there was still a lot of capability building, but we had a team, we had some capacity, so I wasn't having to fight for staff, if you like. I think the other thing that happened that actually looking back was quite key was that we had a CQC inspection where we received a requires improvement notice, and there was lots of recommendations in there around care planning and documentation. That was quite a big theme. And I think we were maybe a year into sort of our QI program, and I sort of argued, that there was discussion about what do we need to do to address this. Is it about doing more training? And I'm like, really argued it's not about doing more training, because actually staff know what good care planning and documentation is. There's a barrier in there that's stopping them from doing that. So let's try and understand that. So we sort of argued and got approval to start a QI collaborative looking at care planning and documentation. So it was called the QIAC. And again, shout out to any of the team from NELF that were involved in that. It was a lot of work at the time, but we ran a collaborative with the teams that were mentioned in the CQC report, and actually saw some really great outcomes, some real improvements, and then ran another cohort. So that I think what that did was give us a real chance to prove that some of this methodology can really work and it can make a difference, and can do that top-down, bottom-up thing of, we've got an organisational priority that's been, you know, through that CQC report, we have to improve care planning and documentation, but let's work with the teams and what are their ideas for how we do that. Every team focused on something different, but with the same measurement tool and the same aim. So I think it really gave us a chance quite early on to really prove that it can work and it can do both. And if we hadn't had that, it might have taken a bit longer to get where we managed to go to, I think. So
that
opportunities.
Yeah, that burning platform is so important, and it's usually the root of most organizations kind of QI story, whether it's a CQC or an inspection from a kind of external organization. That's usually what puts the drive. Good to hear as well that you have a team. I think having a quality improvement, a QI team, is so important, because actually I think there is some evidence out there to suggest that clinical people are probably the worst folk to do kind of QI, because they're so embedded in the issues and problems that it's helpful to have that team that kind of stand back and can go in and help them and give them a wee bit of kind of objectivity around what they're seeing and experiencing.
And getting that balance right is challenging as well, isn't it? Because, you know, absolutely, team, they want to help, but actually getting the balance right, that team are there to equip people with the skills to facilitate people around their quality improvement project. They're not there to do the quality improvement, because actually if the team got really, you know, bogged down in the detail of the project, they wouldn't, their reach and spread would then be really small. So, and that message was really difficult to get right at times as well, that, you know, we're here to help you, we're not here to do it for you, and we'll give you the skills and give you the expertise. And I think, as I was reflecting back when we were talking earlier about, you know, clinicians going into quality improvement, and initially all of our teams were from clinical backgrounds, we did change that, because actually we had some great people and we're like, we're not giving you an opportunity to get into quality improvement. So we did change that. But initially they were all from clinical backgrounds. And I think sometimes at times wrestled with that, you know, that I'm a nurse, or I'm an occupational therapist, or I'm a speech and language therapist. And am I really making a difference in this kind of role? But I think being able to feel that they were making a difference across a wider services and, you know, wider parts of the organization than you can necessarily as a clinician, where your impact is on, you know, your patients that day. But I think that was a really important thing to manage with the team as well, that you are still making a difference. It's in a different way, and actually you're facilitating more people to make a difference with the role that you're in.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I never thought about framing it that way, because, you know, clinical staff will almost see not always an immediate, but a fairly close kind of visual of the impact that they're having on their patient. They do something, the patient's going to respond in a certain way. But, you know, in QI, when you're leading change, that can sometimes feel like, is it ever going to happen? Is the impact ever going to come? And then sometimes, you know, the penny drops, so you reach that tipping point, and all of a sudden that thing you're trying to achieve just starts to happen naturally, and that can sometimes take a while. I mean, it's a whole other podcast about kind of resilience of QI staff and how you kind of manage that, because it can be quite kind of demoralizing. But let's focus on a positive thing, because within NHS 24 at the moment, as we were recording this chat, you guys are in the middle of Quality Month. We are having a month-long focus on kind of quality and QI. Can you tell us a wee bit more about that? It sounds really exciting.
Yeah, so I think NHS 24 is, I guess, earlier in its QI journey than we had gotten to in NELFT. So it's really interesting reflecting on some of the learning, I guess, from what we did in NELFT and where we're at in NHS 24. But I think it was felt that we just really needed to do a big push around sort of messaging around quality and quality improvement. So it's not just about quality improvement, it's a wider quality agenda as well. And by doing sort of a month just get a bit of momentum and a bit of excitement around that. There's a whole programme of activities over the month, so a huge well done to the QI team for pulling it all together and to all of the teams that are involved in it. But just really to get that message out there that quality is really important. There's a lot of work happening around quality and quality improvement. So let's tell you about that work, but also let's tell you about some of the ways that you can get involved in that work as well, and that whole message that, you know, QI is here for you, it's for everyone. So yeah, it's really exciting, just to get that initial excitement going about quality.
And the stuff that's been shared so far looks fantastic. On Twitter, NHS24's Twitter account, or members of the team, Dan and Scott, are kind of tweeting and sharing information as well. And it's fantastic. It's really good. And before we come on the call, we were talking about how.
Definitely not, but hopefully it really made a difference as to how people feel and that they've got control of something within the space that they work. So, you know, it's not just about the actual results, is it? It's that impact on people that's really important.
That's so important, and yeah, such a big part of that improvement journey for individuals and teams and organizations is the impact that it's having in relationships and culture. And sounds fantastic. Well, listen, Laura, thanks very much for joining us. I've learned a lot today, a wee bit about EHPs, a wee bit more about what NHS24 does. And I'll see you at that graduation event, actually, because it's happening in my backyard, so I'll be there in
Oh,
person.
that'd be great.
But the sounds of it, there's going to be some good projects, and hopefully a lot of happy, motivated people having a chat.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Laura. Thank you again to Laura for joining us and having a wonderful conversation with me. I was really pleased to do this and help Laura promote and talk a wee bit about the NHS 24 Quality Month, which, as I said, is ongoing, and you can find out more about that on the socials, on particularly on Twitter. And you can also visit the NHS 24 website to find out a wee bit more. All that's left for me to say again is thanks for joining me. Make sure you follow along on Twitter at @theQI_guy for all updates and future episodes. Make sure you kind of subscribe to the podcast, wherever you get your podcast, and maybe leave us a little review or a little comment how we could improve. Since we are focused on improvement, that would be fantastic. But until next time, take care.